And with me is internationally known composer Vincent Persichetti. Persichetti was born in Philadelphia in 1915 and continues to make his home in the city. He studied at the Philadelphia Conservatory and the Curtis Institute of Music. From 1942 to 62, he headed the composition department of the Philadelphia Conservatory, and he's been on the faculty of the Juilliard Composition Department since 1948. Persichetti is one of the few American composers who has written extensively for concert bands. He's also guest-taught in universities around the world. His book on harmony is still used as a text in many universities. A new work by Persichetti will be performed this Friday, April 20th, by the Philadelphia Singers, under the direction of Michael Korn, with accompaniment by the Concerto Soloists of Philadelphia. This new piece, Flower Songs, is set to poems by E.E. Cummings. The composition was commissioned by and is dedicated to Michael Korn and the Philadelphia Singers. The performance will be this Friday at the Academy of Music. The program begins at 8 o'clock. And for more information, you can call 732-3370. That's 732-3370. Before we meet Vincent Persichetti, let's listen to one of his compositions for concert band. This is a piece called Pageant. It's performed by the Northwestern University Symphonic Wind Ensemble with John Painter conducting.
Thank you.
We heard Pageant, composed by my guest Vincent Persichetti, featuring the Northwestern University Symphonic Wind Ensemble, conducted by John Painter. I want to remind you that a new work by Vincent Persichetti will be premiered this Friday evening. It's called Flower Songs, with poems by E.E. Cummings, and performing will be the Philadelphia Singers under the direction of Michael Korn. Vincent Persichetti, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a great pleasure to meet you.
Nice to be here.
I'd like to talk about your life and your music. So before we talk about the present and mm-hmm. your new piece, let's talk about the past. When did you first become interested in music? Was your music self-initiated initially? Were you interested in it, or did your parents decide that you'd be?
I became very interested in it when I was 2 years old.
That's very young.
Yes. And my parents were not musicians, but we did have a player piano, a Cunningham player piano. And I listened to my father play this piano, and I discovered how he played it. He pushed pedals. And when he would go to work, he worked at the PSFS, as a matter of fact, here in Philadelphia. I would try to work those pedals, and the only way I could do it would be to close the keyboard cover and hang on there with two hands and pump the thing. And about when I was three, I wanted to start piano lessons. I'd heard about this, and I was very interested. And my parents didn't think I was old enough to study piano, and they didn't know anything about music. They thought I should learn to read and write first. So I hurried up some spelling, got some words together, and finally convinced them to let me go study when I was about 5 years old. So that's a long wait for me. I still resent the fact that I had to wait for 3 years to get started. Music seemed to be the best way to speak to someone else, and I just had to find out what a piece of music looked like. And they allowed me to go when I was five-ish instead of six or seven, because the president of the conservatory, that was the Combs Conservatory, is where I started. Later it was the Philadelphia Conservatory. The president used to sit on the front stoops, and he lived three or four houses down from us on South Broad Street. So he would talk to me because I was a five-year-old, and I could ask him about why can't I study, and so forth, and piano. And I think that he said maybe this person could study. So my mother took me down for my first lesson, and I was in tears because I couldn't study with Gilbert Reynolds Combs because he was the president of the conservatory. And then I got a fine teacher, and I started. And I remember seeing the first music that I ever saw. It was called First Step of 10 Steps. And it was a piece that Mr. Combs wrote himself. And they were mostly quarter notes. And quarter notes with tails going up, stems going down. And I said, oh, that's easy. They're all sixes and nines. So I felt that this wasn't going to be something horrible. You know, just I knew I had to learn this. You know, it could be as complicated. I didn't know, but suddenly it seemed possible to me. Then I started to make up melodies, because the 10 steps were kind of slow for me, because I would concentrate on learning the first step, and it was a little bit boring, so I put extra notes in. And that's how I got started writing, I guess.
Mm-hmm. How did you get through those periods of frustration when something was too difficult for you and a little out of your grasp?
You mean after I started lessons?
Yeah, after you started lessons. Because I think that a lot of children who start off mm-hmm. loving music, when they get to that place where it's really difficult to learn something, get very frustrated and get overwhelmed with that frustration.
I didn't go through that for some reason. I think my teacher, Warren Eastanger was his name then, was careful to not move me too fast, I suppose. But when I heard a lot of music that I, of course, couldn't play, and that was enough for me for then. And I would analyze that music, and I would, at a very early age, began looking at scores. And a lot of my education was at the Logan Square Library. And when I started to go to the Philadelphia Orchestra, now I was 10-ish maybe, I would study the scores of the concert coming up, and I would usually pick out one that I would try to memorize or really envision how it sounded. And I'd go to the Logan Square Library, bring it home, and I wouldn't play it on the piano, or I'd try to just envision what it sounded like. This, I think, is how I learned to really read. And my friend Leopold Stokowski was the conductor, and I would match what I had heard in my head with what I was hearing the orchestra play. And it got so that I can remember going to hear Rimsky-Korsakov, Scheherazade, for the first time. I didn't have records at home. And I had studied maybe half of the work in that week. And I knew it so well, I had never heard it. It was as though I had written the piece. And it was like going to a first rehearsal, a reading rehearsal of my new work. And then I'd be surprised that the flutes sounded as well as they did, or the trombones were heard when I thought they weren't going to be heard, whatever it was. I would match up what I had envisioned in my mind and make the corrections. And if you do this once or 50 times, that doesn't do much. But I would do this hundreds and hundreds of times year after year. So you get to, by when you're 18 or 19, you have already had orchestral experience, even if you not have never heard a work of your own. And I had that kind of background, along with, when I was 11, I joined the Matinee Musical Club Orchestra as pianist. And I remember we did the Unfinished Symphony of Schubert and the Magic Flute of Mozart. Now, there's no piano part in those pieces, but I was there to play the missing parts. We didn't always have a full orchestra. So one night I might be playing bassoon and a fourth horn and a whatever, you know, a second flute. And that helped me to learn to... In other words, I never was overwhelmed by anything that I didn't understand. I just... found things in my own terms, and I guess when I have troubles, I ignore the troubles. I make more of what I do understand.
I guess that skill that you develop by taking home all the music and being able to hear it in your head,
sure,
is essential as a composer. I guess you have to be able to hear different sections in your head in order to write.
You have to be able to hear music without it's being played. Sure, it has to be in your head.
Is that something you can teach?
Yeah, I think so. Up to a point. You know, for instance, can you envision what the Star Spangled Banner sounds like? And you can start to sing the notes. Right?
Mm-hmm.
And then if you were taught that da-da is an F and a D and a minor third away, you begin to see those things as you hear them. And a composer, Beethoven, I was sorry he went kind of deaf later, but not really, because he could hear in his inner ear and he wrote.
Mm-hmm.
He would have trouble when he conducted because he couldn't hear what was going on, maybe. But the inner ear is tremendous. It's essential for the composer.
At what point in your life did you know with certainty that your life was going to be devoted to music?
Before I was 3. I know that, yeah. And I didn't care as I got older. When I was 6 or 7 or even older, I didn't care how I'd make a living. I always knew I could maybe mow lawns and live in a piano crate or some shack to write my music. So I never thought about it in those terms.
Were there years when you had to have other jobs to support your music before you were able to apply for a living?
Well, see, I've never had a job yet.
Really?
No, I don't think of it as that. I was just fortunate to, be teaching or so-called at the Combs Conservatory. When I got my bachelor degree, my real composition teacher, I studied with a lot of people, but the basic one was Russell King Miller. And I knew he wasn't well when I was a senior, but over the summer he died, and this school wasn't as strong as it had been because there were new schools had come up by then, Curtis and Juilliard, and with scholarships. So the school was kind of relaxing a bit, and they asked me to take over the department. So I'm 21, just graduated. And I guess that's how I learned how to evaluate, to focus on style traits of composers. Now, I wasn't ready to teach. I had to teach myself, and I would find ways that I'd read the harmony books, and I had studied harmony and counterpoint many times, but I never could swallow them as they were. I had to find more general reasons for how... causes, what materials made harmonies move up, down, slantwise, obliquely. See, I had started theory when I was 9, and I did the equivalent of college by the time I was 14. That doesn't mean that I was precocious. What we do in college can be done way before that, theoretically. And I had studied that with Russell King Miller privately in halls, and he'd asked me to visit his classes sometimes, his college classes. So when I was ready to go to the bachelor courses there, I was repeating a lot of things, but I did it then in a deeper way, and I would meet after the classes with Russell King Miller. For instance, people will tell you a 5-7 chord goes to a 1 chord, or the dissonant tone goes down. It's not necessarily true. If you're talking about 5-7 in a major key, the 7th is the dissonant, it goes down. But not because the dissonant goes down, it's because the 4th scale step of a major scale is closer to the 3rd. I don't want to get too technical now. So that's going down is not where it goes. It goes to the nearest note. Now, if you have an unusual inversion of a chord, or you have a different kind of formation, the rule still holds true. You go to the nearest note. It may be up then, you see, or some go in either direction. It's that kind of training I came to, and conclusions I came. So I've never applied for a job. I'm trying to answer your question. I found I was doing something I wanted to do in Combs, and I floated into the conservatory, and William Schumann asked me to go to Juilliard, and I don't call those jobs. It's just what I would do naturally. You know, I'm with whatever, director of publications at a publishing firm, Elkan Vogel, theater presser. And originally, that was in 52 when I went to Elkan Vogel. And that wasn't a job either, because that I would be there for a few hours looking at new music, which I would be doing had I not had that job. So I think that when a musician gets out of college, finally gets a doctor's degree, whatever it is, the only hope he has then is to finally become a student. So I'm a student without a job, okay?
Well, I want to talk more about your experiences as composer and teacher, but let's listen first to one of your compositions.
I love music by a lot of my colleagues, too.
Okay. We're going to hear two movements from a mass that you wrote, Opus 84, performed by the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia with Tamara Brooks conducting.
And this is a wonderful, wonderful performance, okay.
Can you say a little bit about this before we hear it?
This I call my Swarthmore Mass. I did some guest teaching there in the middle 50s, whenever that was, 57, 58, I can't remember now. And I was working on that mass, and I'd have coffee there in the faculty room, and I can just remember that year having written the mass. And this was premiered by the Collegiate Chorale in New York, and it was a very beautiful performance. And people began picking this up. As a matter of fact, Michael Korn has done this many times with the Philadelphia Singers. And Tamara Brooks, we've been colleagues for years. In fact, she was studying at the Juilliard. We work very closely on a lot of contemporary music and other kinds. And this is what I think is a definitive performance for her. Maybe she has to do it 4 or 5 more times to be definitive. Maybe Michael Korn does, I don't know, but both those conductors do this in their own way. They're not the same, but they're both very meaningful. And it's nice that we can hear this, a little bit of this, because this will get ready for us on Friday to listen to another wonderful choral conductor, Michael Korn, do a brand new work of mine. And when both these conductors do works of mine, if it's a premiere, it'll always be musical, which makes me happy, always meaningfully done. I cannot stand performances that are just perfect and no shape, no phrase shapes, no harmonic momentum, so that I would guess that this performance on Friday night will be such that if you don't like the piece, you've heard the piece, so you won't, I can't blame the performance. It's going to be a meaningful performance. It'll be clear. I love the piece, the Flower Songs. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, and we will. And, yeah. And I want to mention to our listeners that this piece, the Flower Songs, will be premiered this Friday evening by Michael Korn conducting the Philadelphia Singers. That will be at the Academy of Music at 8 o'clock. The piece we're going to hear now is the Mass Opus 84. We'll hear the Kyrie and the Gloria. And performing is the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia under the direction of Tamara Brooks. The composer is my guest, Vincent Persichetti. That was Tamara Brooks conducting the Mendelssohn Club of Philadelphia in a performance of the Kyrie and Gloria of Vincent Persichetti's Mass, Opus 84. And by the way, Tamara Brooks will be conducting the New School in a performance of Vincent Persichetti's Fourth Symphony on May 13th at the Academy of Music. And a week before that, she will be conducting that piece at Carnegie Hall. My guest is composer Vincent Persichetti, who lives in Philadelphia, teaches at the Juilliard School of Music. And a new one of his pieces, Flower Songs, will be performed, actually premiered, this Friday at the Academy of Music in a performance that begins at 8 o'clock. Performing will be the Philadelphia Singers under conductor Michael Korn. Vincent Persichetti, you've been teaching ever since you've been old enough to teach.
Mm-hmm. I guess so.
I think basically before you were an adult, you were teaching.
Yeah.
Do you think that competition within music schools has changed a lot since you were in school?
Well, first place, I like to think about this is not a teaching thing, but as a sharing music with students. And I find that many of the schools around the country have a few things that are very important to them and in common. I often am a visiting composer in universities around the country. I think I've been in 47 states now. There's a big difference between the 60s and the 80s in music. In the 60s, it started in actually in 1952, 53, composers were seeking out new materials, new ways of writing. And sometimes the composer would be more excited about the newness of what he was doing rather than the quality of what he was doing. Nevertheless, even those composers whose pieces were not really strong did contribute sounds that a more sensitive composer would be affected by. And you had almost cliques, certain composers that would do a certain kind of post Webern thing, and another group would be writing kind of a 12-tone post Luciano Berio. There'd be composers doing a post Howard Hanson kind of thing. And I would say 40% of that music that was written was very avant-garde. And about half of that were violently so and completely serialized and tight. In the 80s, the composers have begun reshaping their serial writing and allowing places where tonality will take over, not in a 19th century way, but in a new kind of atonal, tonal, modal, polymixed kind of key center. And most of the composers around the country tend to be writing a music that has focus and is direct and meaningful, but comprises a mixture of materials that have been bequeathed to all of us now.
Did you expect that would happen during the avant-gardism of the 60s?
Yes, I did. Uh-huh. And it's just a few years old. By the end of the century, turn of the century, I think we'll be ready with a almost common practice, the ability to use all these materials and be so apt at this that the talent or the lack of talent in these composers can be more obviously projected. And I envision a new, rich kind of music in the next century. Now, I'm not talking about things that are backing up. I'm not talking about going back to Romanticism. There's something that goes that's an Eastern island that's been doing that recently. A small island, it's called Manhattan, I guess, where they've done this, New York City. And it's only 12 blocks wide. It's a little. Most of that, a good bit of that, is going back to 19th century Romanticism. There's a new kind of Romanticism that combines these other materials. And in this festival we all know about in New York City, there are some really fine new Romantic pieces in there. And we're going to get to the point where we can go, first place, I can't imagine life without love. I can't imagine music without love. I can't imagine walking without the romance of the moon, if there's a moon that day. And we'll always have this, but it will be a new kind of Romanticism, the kind that may become worried. It won't just stay happy and walking around, pacing garden borders. This is music that may make a peculiar twist and a turn. It may hit a froggy, frosty note like a beautiful pop singer does. Some of the greatest artists we have now are the pop people. And that may sour, and it may bring in a very neurotic guilt passage that might go into a kind of music that will out Schoenberg or Webern. And from that, a certain strictness of consciousness of all 12 tones, it may go into microtones. And we're already getting to that. And then get back to something that is very liquid and might be as beautiful and solid as a Bach chorale. But it won't be a chorale that Bach could have written. It'll be a new, our own music. It's here. We have it, the beginnings of this infused rock these days.
How do you think avant-garde harmonies have affected your own composition?
They've always been there with me, and they've, I think, given me more strength, maybe, to use them. I don't know. But in works like my Janiculum Symphony, the Ninth Symphony, or part of the four-hand piano concerto, which you might even hear a little bit of today, that's an example of those are works that get into kind of freaked-out harmonies at times, you know. And they have affected me very much, the sound, but I give them meaning. Meaning in a place, in a phrase or formal setup of a piece. I just don't spurt them out. And I think there's nothing wrong with spurting out chords and having just a surface kind of piece and sounds. But I want other things also. In my life, I like things to relate to others. And I like sounds, ugly or otherwise, to be earned. See, I can never stand music that is ugly, but I do love music that is about ugliness. There's a difference, you see? And I don't like music that is beautiful, just per se. I like music that is about beautiful music. And the cantata you're going to hear next week has a lot to do with this in the words of deep depth of meaning.
Well, since you just mentioned your concerto for piano for four hands, I thought
yes. This
would be a good time to listen.
Oh, yeah.
To some of it.
People think it's two pianos. It's one piano, and with one of my favorite women, my wife, Dorothea Persichetti, we're playing there. And we premiered this in Pittsburgh. It was the Pittsburgh International Festival, where composers from all over the world were commissioned to write. And this, I don't like to write on commission. I never do. But the commission happened to coincide with what I wanted to do, and I got very involved with this, and we recorded this for a company called Columbia Records, and we got a little fussy during the day, and we try things over and make takes and so forth. And before we walked out, we had enough takes to have a good record. Before we walked out, we talked to the producer, who was Howard Scott. I remember his name, Howard Scott, a wonderful guy. We said, "How about this takes 27 minutes? Do you have another half hour?" "Oh yeah, we have time. Let us go through it, and don't stop us." And we played it through. I wanted to be sure I got the shape of it, and that's what you hear on the record, is a playthrough after working all day on takes, with one exception where I dropped a note, and I bought a razor at the drugstore, I guess, and fixed it up. I don't know that one note. I don't know how they do it.
Well, let's hear the presto from Vincent Persichetti's Concerto for Piano, Four Hands, Opus 56. And on this, he performs with his wife, Dorothea Persichetti.
Right. Thank you.
We've been listening to the Presto from Vincent Persichetti's Concerto for Piano Four Hands, Opus 56, performed by the composer with his wife Dorothea Persichetti at the piano. And my guest is Vincent Persichetti, and he, by the way, lives in Philadelphia. And a new piece of his, Flower Songs, will be premiered this Friday evening at the Academy of Music. Performing will be the Philadelphia Singers under the direction of Michael Korn. You were saying before we heard the concerto that this piece was commissioned, but you don't really like to do commissioned pieces. Why not?
Well, I just am a free agent, and let's put it this way. I never start to write a piece. I hear sounds in my head, and when I do, I always hear them in a medium. And then whatever that medium is, I can't gauge beforehand what it's going to be. That becomes my piece. And I started out with never trying to make a living as a composer. I just wanted to write my music. I was teaching in schools and so forth. So that if somebody commissions me in a medium that I'm working in, I'm happy, obviously. And if it's an orchestral work, there are thousands of dollars expenses you have and parts and so forth. Fine. But if... right now, I don't want to mention names, but there's a big commission I have from a major orchestra, not in this area, that I had to refuse. They gave me, I thought about it for about a year now or so forth, and I knew I wasn't going to be wanting to write this kind of a piece for that medium. Now, obviously, I have nine symphonies. I like the medium. It isn't that. It's that I want to do some other things, and I'm free to do this. And I'm writing some harpsichord sonatas right now. Some are commissioned, some are not. But that's what I'm about. I don't want somebody... I just don't feel happy if somebody tells me I have to write something.
No. You've written a lot of pieces for symphonic band, which is a configuration that I think not that many people write for, perhaps because most bands, I think, are affiliated with universities.
I've never written for band. That's a misunderstanding. I have pieces that say band on it. I was writing... I used to spend summers in Kansas, and summer of 49, I was writing some music, and there were some loud winds, woodwind chords, and they were being wrestled with by some brass chords, and pretty soon the timpani came in, and there was a lot of trouble there. And I was writing and writing. Gradually, I realized that the strings were never going to come in. So this, I realized I had what is called a band work, and they call it wind ensemble now sometimes. I was lucky enough to approach it fresh. You see, the band is a great medium. All mediums are wonderful. It's just that when you have a lot of bad band music or bad arrangements of orchestral scores for a band, or you have poor conductors, poor performers, and always outside on gum-coated park benches, then it becomes an awful medium for people. That's just the abuse of the medium. I just always had a respect for wind instruments and percussion, brass and woodwinds, and I found myself writing. My first piece was a divertimento for band. That was that first thing. And I eventually wrote a symphony for a band. Symphony, four movements, but no strings came in. Great. I wrote a symphony once for strings, where the woodwinds didn't come in, or the brass didn't come in, or percussion, this is how I do my thing. I wrote a harpsichord sonata in the 50s and haven't written one until maybe a year ago, and my seventh has been just premiered in Rochester. It's just that my world, when I with a harpsichord, becomes, that's the whole world. And I just, my ideas are coming that way, and fine. And meanwhile, I wrote this cantata for Michael Korn. And as a matter of fact, there's an example of a commission. He commissioned me, and I said, no, I couldn't do it. I wasn't thinking that way, but he was a very close friend of mine, only for years. I said, but I can't say no to you. If I ever get ideas, I had some things about flower songs, I'll be in touch with you. And he politely would call me once in a while and check. And finally, I was ready for it. He waited, and I think the story is something like this. Then I was lucky to have a person that could not make a point of it. So this is something I want to write. They did commission it, thank goodness, but, if they hadn't commissioned it, they couldn't have stopped me from writing it. I would have written it.
We can't listen to it now because it hasn't been recorded yet. Could you describe it?
Well, I wrote a couple of days ago a program note for the thing. It's it's a text of E.E. Cummings, who's one of my very favorite poets. I like all his good poetry. So some I don't like. Okay. But one of my first pieces for chorus was a piece called Sam Was a Man on his Tex and Jimmy's Got a Goyle. And he gave me the rights to set anything of his I wanted to, which is a very unusual thing for poetry from a poet, because he knew I respected these words and words in general. And I have a special thing about words. And I don't like novels unless they're really poetry. That's the essence of writing. Here's what I wrote for the program note for Friday. Cantata number 6 was written because I love the moon and stars and the flowers that flourish under them. I love poetry about meaningful matters more than subjects themselves. Poetry distills and avoids paralleling the actual time of events. My cantata does not attempt to describe, but rather express my reactions to such subjects as, now these are words here and there from Cummings, children wound with stone flowers. That's not such a happy song. Imagine what that means. A locomotive spouting violets. If you want to know more about it, hear my piece or read Cummings' poem. Moist eyes at kisses playing. This is meaningful to me. Quite softly as your hair. And one is deals with a dead yellow small rose. These are not titles. These are just lines that strike me from the cantata. The petals hush mysteriously. And there's one place where he says, don't cry, dear violet. And we get these. To me, poetry is a strong part of our life. I sum it up with a line like this: life is more than life. Poetry does that to words. And you can just live with 5 words that day if you want to. This is a cantata in 7 movements, and it's for chorus and string orchestra. And here's this Philadelphia Singers. Can you imagine who the string orchestra is? The concerto soloists. I never dreamed they would come and play my piece. So I'm looking forward to this. And I'm so happy with this that's happened this year with Tamara Brooks' Mass recording. So I think I'll just go home and write another harpsichord sonata for some other angel.
Was this piece, Flower Songs, with chorus, did it sound, when you heard it performed, like you had imagined it would sound in your head?
Yes. Oh, yes. I get pretty close to that, yeah. That's my early days of going to hear the concerts with Stokowski, having memorized the scores. There are always a few surprises that could possible, a certain adjustment, a certain doubling maybe. But I couldn't write unless I heard them like they were live.
We're just about out of time, but given that you can hear all of this in your head as you're composing, do you prefer to compose at a piano or do you just need some paper in front of you?
I prefer being away from the piano. I can keep my perspective better. I can get seduced at a piano. So I do, when I drive around the country or travel, I do a lot of driving. A lot of writing, excuse me. I do a lot of driving. And but if I get near a piano, if there's one near, I will jump to it to test things. But I have to be careful. I pull myself away, especially if you have a good piano. I happen to have a new Steinway now, and I have to be careful because I can play a chord or two that sounds so beautiful because the piano is.
Uh-huh.
I have to watch that. So I have to push myself away from the piano sometimes.
Well, it's really been enjoyable to speak with you, Eric Grant. We're out of time.
Nice to talk to you. You seem to like music.
Yeah, I do, and I enjoy your music, and I want to thank you
a lot for
being here.
Right.
And Vincent Persichetti's new piece, the one we were just discussing, Flower Songs, will be premiered this Friday, April 20th, by the Philadelphia Singers under the direction of Michael Korn, with accompaniment by the Concerto Soloists of Philadelphia. That's this Friday evening, beginning at 8 o'clock at the Academy of Music. For more information, you can call 732-3370. That's 732-3370. And then also on May 13th in Philadelphia, Tamara Brooks will be conducting the New School of Music, and they'll be performing Vincent Persichetti's 4th Symphony. That will be at the Academy of Music, and she'll also be conducting that piece a week before at Carnegie Hall. Vincent Persichetti lives in Philadelphia, teaches at the Juilliard School of Music, and again, I want to thank you for talking with us. It's 2 minutes to 5 o'clock, and we'll be joining National Public Radio at 5 for tonight's edition of All Things Considered. I'll tell you what's happening tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air after this report from Shadow Traffic.
Good afternoon, everyone. If you're making your way home this afternoon on the eastbound Schuylkill Expressway, you'll find it slow from the Lee's Point curve through approaching Gladwin. Traffic moving at 15 to 30 miles an hour there due to an earlier accident on the side. Westbound Expressway is slow from west of Belmont through west of Gladwin. Southbound Roosevelt Boulevard, it's slow from south of 9th through the Wayne Avenue overpass due to an earlier disabled vehicle. Northbound 95 is moving along well at this point. Southbound 95, the Platte Detour Road, there's some slowing at Island. Also, westbound 291, you'll find it slow for over a half a mile approaching Bartram. Westbound East River Drive is slow approaching the Twin Bridges. That is due to construction, and there is one lane of traffic moving in each direction. Also, westbound Vine is slow from just west of 22nd through to the expressway. That's Shadow Traffic for WHYY 91 FM. This is John Barry.
The Shadow Traffic Report was funded by Wilkie Buick Subaru. Tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air at 3 o'clock, part 3 of our series Latin USA, portraits of 4 Hispanic American communities. Tomorrow's program will be devoted to San Antonio, Texas. At 3:30, I'll speak with Jay Ruby, who's the editor of the new book Robert J. Flaherty, a biography of the documentary filmmaker. And at 4 o'clock, I'll speak with Lori Lewin, author of the new book, My Life as a Stripper, and she spent several years as a stripper and is now a feminist. So that's all coming up tomorrow afternoon on Fresh Air. I hope you can be listening. If you have any questions or comments about Fresh Air, please write to us. Our address is WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. That's Fresh Air, WHYY Radio, 150 North 6th Street, Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, 19106. Julie Burstein contributed to today's show. Paul Keller was the technical director. Maeve McGoran is the associate producer of the program. Danny Miller, the co-producer. My name's Terry Gross. I want to thank you for listening, and I wish you a great evening. This is WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. We're listener-supported public radio in the Delaware Valley.
Good evening from National Public Radio in Washington. This is Noah Adams.
And I'm Susan Stamberg with All Things Considered.
Passing the mantle, that's an old tradition. It's very aristocratic, that's why we like it, right? Everybody feels like kings and queens.
Theater is full of ritual, and tonight in All Things Considered, we sample one of its most charming traditions, backstage on opening night with producer Joseph Papp and others, for the ceremonial passing of the gypsy robe.
Also, how to ask the right questions of the Central Intelligence Agency.
Another acquittal in North Carolina for members of the Ku Klux Klan and the American Nazi Party.
A mass killing in Brooklyn, possibly drug-related.
A tax fight on the border between Oregon and Washington.
Also, moisturizer as a religion.
That and more this evening on All Things Considered. First, we have this hour's news.
This is Brian Naylor. The chief of security at the U.S. Embassy in San Salvador was shot and killed today. Joaquim Alfredo Zapata Romero died at the scene from 4 bullet wounds. His wife was also wounded in the attack. An unidentified gunman in the passenger seat of a taxi pulled up beside Zapata's car, which was stopped at a major intersection in San Salvador, and opened fire. The gunman and the taxi driver sped from the scene about a mile from the embassy. No group claimed responsibility, and police said they had no leads. President Reagan has signed a new national security directive, which, according to published reports, would enhance the ability of U.S. intelligence gathering agencies to fight terrorism at home and abroad. NPR's Catherine Ferguson reports.
The Los Angeles Times was the first of several news organizations to report that earlier this month, the president signed a new directive calling for beefed-up intelligence gathering by the CIA and the FBI. The aim would be to learn of planned terrorist activities before they happen. The bombing of the Beirut airport last October, which resulted in the death of more than 200 Marines, heightened existing concern within the administration. This new executive order reportedly calls for establishing paramilitary CIA and FBI squads who, along with a Pentagon military unit, might engage in what's called preemptive strikes. But all news accounts say the administration's interagency review panel studying anti-terrorism measures ruled out assassinations of known and suspected terrorists. The administration's interest in developing anti-terrorism measures is not new. The president said as much in his State of the Union address to the Congress. And by all accounts, he will now have to return to the Congress to get approval for much of the anti-terrorism initiative.